Hey everybody, it's Mark Patterson. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Before I get to my amazing guest for this week, I want to draw attention to my new book that just came out with the same name called Finding Your Summit: How to Build Resilience and Faith to Rise Above Life's Challenges. Kristen, I'm sure you know about that. Also, I have an event coming to Sun Valley, Idaho, called the Seven Summits Summit. It's going to be amazing. This fall, we rise. Go to my new website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. And the last thing I will say is I am out on the public speaking circuit. I love talking to audiences about running Sports Illustrated, climbing the Seven Summits, playing in the NFL, winning an Emmy for my movie that the NFL Films did about my epic climb up and down Mount Everest. So you can check it out all on the website. On that note, we'll transition to my guest today. Kristen, how are you doing?
I am really good. I slept 10 hours last night.
Amazing. I have a hard time sleeping too, right? I don't know if that's what you didn't say that. I just made that up, but I have a hard time. I sleep like 6 to 7 hours a night, and I get up every couple hours, and it's just like it's helped me in the mountains with mountaineering because you climb during the night when things are frozen, but it's probably not the best thing for your overall health, right?
I can help you with that. If somebody has a hard time sleeping, it's usually because they have a compromised relationship with fear during the day. It means they're not dealing with their fear during the day. And so fear will get clever. It'll invade your mind or your body and wake you up at night and keep you up at night as a way to say, stop ignoring me. And once you learn how to turn towards the fear rather than try to turn away yet again, then you sleep better.
Yeah, I don't think that's my issue. But anyways, we'll get to that in a minute because I want to give this. I know that one of the things that you do now is you help people overcome fear and anxiety, which is
No,
amazing.
no, no, no. Hold
You
on. That
don't.
has to be really, really crystal clear. I
Okay.
do not help people overcome fear. I
Oh.
teach the exact opposite.
Okay.
Because everybody on the planet that has an opinion about fear says that it's something to be overcome and conquered.
Yeah.
And I say it's something to be connected with. So, overcome, conquered, that's really combative, warlike language. Like, I'm going to fight my fear, right? I do not teach that. I actually say that that is a really poor approach to fear and causes a lot of problems for people. And the subtitle of my book, The Art of Fear, is Why Conquering Fear Won't Work and What to Do Instead. So we really need to establish that
No,
really.
thank you so much for clearing that up for me. So before we get into that, because I've got a lot of my own experience around that, and like climbing the Matterhorn, I was terrified, right? And we'll talk about that in a minute. But you are a former, you're still a skier, of course, but a high altitude jump off big things, cliffs, everything else. You were known as the best woman skier for 12 years. I don't know how you get to that title or not, but whether you're fit somewhere in that whole ecosystem, when you're jumping off 300-foot cliffs and landing in the snow, and I saw some of the video of you and doing crazy things. You're also friends with my friend, Mike Catrip, in the Hall of Fame. I mean, it's a pretty impressive thing that you've been able to do. So, how did you originally even get into that? Like, most people don't say, hey, I want to go jump off this cliff that's so, 100, 200, 300 feet up.
How I got into it, I was a mogul skier. I was on the US ski team for moguls, and I was simultaneously being offered to go heli skiing in Canada and jump off cliffs into powder. And I had to pick one or the other. And back then, you had to be an amateur athlete to be on the US ski team, and I didn't have rich parents. So for me, it was obvious the choice, like, oh, we're going to pay you to go jump off cliffs into powder from a hel you know out, not out of a helicopter, but we would
Yeah.
fly around the mountains in a helicopter, and I chose that just because I couldn't afford to be on the US ski team. And I
Yeah.
was really, really good in the air, and that's really what the filmmakers were looking for back then, is somebody that would catch air. And I got a lot of attention and was immediately called the best big mountain extreme skier in the world, and that was a title I kept for 12 years. And I retired in 2003 and haven't looked back, and now I'm a thought leader on fear and anxiety.
Yeah. I've seen some of those movies, back in the day. It was the Warren Miller type stuff, and that was like skiing through, nice sweet powder over moguls and things like that. And Warren Miller, I think, actually started. He was here at Sun Valley, where I live, filming from his VW bus. He started way back, and it just kept, like the stakes kept getting more and more insane. And I think you're a Red Bull sponsored athlete at one point in time. And that's just like the more crazy and insane, and people in wingsuits and all that kind of stuff that, that's what they thrive on, because that brings eyeballs, and people can't, like they're so terrified to do things like that. They want to see somebody else overcome their fear, or maybe they don't have fear, to go and do something crazy like that. And so it's really amazing to me that, for you to go up there and have that kind of mindset to go do those things, knowing that, or maybe not knowing about what the consequences would, reveal once you went off and you're flying through the air and doing these crazy things.
The word extreme means that the consequences of failure are either death or injury. And it was definitely a very dangerous way to make a living for a long time. And I have over 100 friends that have died doing these sports and four ex-boyfriends that have died, actually. So it was definitely very extreme. It's not just extreme in theory, but I was risking my life, and I had probably over 60, 60 near-death experiences during my 12 years, my 12-year reign. And nobody is fearless. I was being talked about in the media as being fearless, and there's a lot of talk about Alex Honnold being fearless and Laird Hamilton being fearless, but none of us are fearless. We all feel fear just like everybody else, despite what the rumors are. What it is more accurately is that we're all addicted to fear. We're all willing to feel fear to an extreme. Like, we love feeling it because it makes us feel alive. Without the fear, we'd be bored or understimulated. And the fear actually is the very thing that took us into the flow states that we are known for. And so the whole concept of the goal is to be fearless, that is actually causing a lot of problems for people. And it's partly it is the reason why there's so much emotional issues and anxiety issues, anger issues, depression, all of that, because it's an unachievable ideal. And when I started becoming a thought leader on fear and anxiety, when my book came out, The Art of Fear, I Googled, like, who on the planet is willing to call themselves a fear expert? And there's nobody. And the reason why is because we believe that if you're a fear expert, you have to A, be fearless, and B, teach people how to be fearless, neither of which is possible or desirable. And that's why, in many ways, I don't really have any competition in being a thought leader on fear and anxiety. Oh, there's my cat.
Fearless, right?
And so that's not what I teach. What I teach, is not the conquering and overcoming fear. What I teach is intimacy with fear, helping us perform better and feel more alive.
So I want to bring this example. I've climbed mountains all over the world, and the one that scared me the most, I always have anxiety when I walk up to a mountain. The first time I was on Mount Rainier and Mount Everest, and some of these other ones, Denali. I mean, they are massive peaks, and there's a lot of very intimidating things that you're going through, and you're going around and climbing over crevasses and things like that. But of all them, this is like 4 years ago. I flew to Zermatt to climb the Matterhorn, and as things all played out, the weather came in. It was mid-September. And there was a big freeze, and they were kind of at the end of the season, climbing season anyhow. And so I walked up to the guy, and I was super scared. I was looking at this thing like, whoa. And I walked up to the guy that ran the hut and organizing the groups that are going up and down. And I go, and I really want to do this. Like, what are the chances of me being able to climb? He goes, let me say it this way, it's 100% chance you'll die. So I redirected things, and I went down to Chamonix, and I ended up climbing Mont Blanc that year. The next year I came back, but I had a whole year. This is where I'm going. I had a whole year to really think about how I was going to get over my fear to go take on the Matterhorn, because it was so visually intimidating to me compared to the other mountains I'd been on. And so for somebody like that, well, like what would be your approach, you know, when you're going and there's this visual looking thing that is really dominating my thoughts and preventing me, I did it, but preventing me from just going into it with I wouldn't say no fear, but how I was going to approach that maybe in a better way than I did.
Well, the key is found in your language. You said, how do I get over the fear? And that's not what we should be going for. You know, it's a perspective shift. Like the whole reason why we would climb the Matterhorn is because we want to feel fear. You know, that's the draw. And we also have to understand that when I say fear, I don't mean scared or afraid. It's not like we go to climb the Matterhorn to feel scared or afraid. Fear is a noun, a feeling of discomfort in our bodies. And it's there like food or oxygen, you know, it's a thing. And scared or afraid are adjectives and only two ways in which fear shows up. And they're very, very rare. And you know, fear can also show up as the new word that we've given it is anxiety. Nobody wants to call it fear anymore because there's too much of a stigma associated with fear. But it also shows up as aliveness, presence, focus, intuition, it even shows up as. And so if you don't invite fear into the process, then you will die. Like you have to, you know, the fear is what makes you smart and sharp and bringing your A game to that those days that matter most. And it's the draw. It's the reason why you're doing this. You know, I'm a skier. The whole reason why people spend so much money on skiing is because of the fear. So we go skiing because of the fear, not despite the fear. So that reframe is the first part. And the second thing I'm going to give you two equations. Fear times resistance equals not what you want. You're rendered dumb and lacking intuition and lacking aliveness. And people just go numb to not feel the fear. They're in their heads all their time, so they don't have to feel the emotion in their body. And being in your head when you're performing is not a good place to perform from. You want to be in your body when you're doing something athletic. You know, everything you want comes from saying yes to fear, being willing to feel fear. And so that the first equation, fear times resistance equals anxiety, depression, insomnia, anger issues, underperforming, you know, none of which we want, of course. Whereas fear times intimacy, you know, connecting with it, feeling it, and then connecting with it in an intimate way equals flow. And Stephen Kotler, the foremost expert alive on flow today, says, oh, when there's fear involved, flow comes for free. I'm like, no. When there's fear involved and we have intimacy with that fear, then the flow comes for free. And flow states is what everybody's talking about right now. And extreme danger sports athletes are notorious for getting into the zone or into those flow states. And why? It's because of the fear, not despite it.
Yeah, I love that. So it was interesting. I've worked out with Laird Hamilton. You mentioned him earlier. He's been on the podcast. I've also worked out with him several times. And you know, he's one of the first guys, if not the first, to take on a 100-foot wave, maybe in Fiji or someplace. And so to me, that's absolutely terrifying, right? I mean, like there's nothing that I go, because I know I would die. That fear, like you put all those words into it, and I can't even imagine that. And for him, climbing Mount Everest, he's giving me the same reaction. And the reason why that is no different than when I'm getting going over the middle when I used to catch passes in the NFL and get my head ripped off, you know, by some safety, is because, and just like Laird started on a 1 foot wave and he started going in the ocean, you know, up to his ankles and then his knees and then his whole body and then swimming out there and catching small waves and building them up. And with me, I started climbing little things up in the Northwest. I grew up in Seattle. And so it was just like, you know, a 2 mile hike up in the woods. So you can't get hurt. And you gradually learn and work your way up, you know, if that's what you want to do. And so like I call measured risk based on starting in a place where I continue just to get and learn and learn and learn more about my craft and what I can do and how I'm going to overcome those things. And so, I don't know if that's the same way you looked at it the first time that you were jumping off a 300-foot cliff, that you were starting with a small jump, which led to a bigger, a 20-foot cliff that, you kept making your way up. So it was measured risk, knowing that what you were landing in is all this snow, not hard bound, but super soft powder, all those things. So the impact was a lot less. So I don't know if you think about those things too, about measured risk that are tied to fear, the way that I like to think about it. And that's really, when I was, I just, when I was climbing the Matterhorn, going back to that, I really, once I came back a year later, I focused on just this next step and the next step and my hands in front of me, and not trying to take the whole enormity of the mountain and the big rock all in one. And that really helped me deal with that. And by the time I got to the top, I was just like, oh my God, I did this, right? Which was a great feeling.
Here's my description of measured risk. And before I get into that, I have never jumped off a 300-foot cliff on skis. Nobody has, unless by accident. I think the world record right now is like 230 feet or something. And if you do that, you slowly go backwards and land on your head. Like it's just physics. And so the biggest cliff I ever jumped off was 70 feet. And that was on skinny skis. So that was, you land in the snow, not on top of the snow.
Well, I can tell you with mad respect for that too. I mean, it's just whether it's 30, 50, I mean, that's way up there.
All right, so here's what my description of what you're describing as measured risk is. And this is something that Alex Honnold and I talked about at length too. And I've talked about this at length with Laird Hamilton, actually. So like here's, and hopefully your people can look at this as a visual, but I'll also describe it if somebody's listening audio. Like here's your comfort zone. It's a circle. And in your comfort zone, you're still going to feel fear. Like people who never leave their house, they still feel fear. It's just part of life. Everyone feels it. And it's with us pretty much every moment of every day in every interaction we have. Most of us are in denial of that. We are embarrassed by that. We don't want to believe it's true, but it is. That's just the way we're designed. It's just always there. And so in your comfort zone, you're still going to feel fear. But if you're willing to feel fear, and that's the key for these sports, like going to climb Everest, surfing a wave, even a 1 foot wave, that's somebody willing to feel fear, willing to step out of their comfort zone, willing to take a risk, which involves fear. So let's say you step out of the comfort zone, put a dot outside the comfort zone. And here's the thing, you never want to go more than 4% out of your comfort zone. And 4% is only if you're young, hungry, and talented, right? Much less than 4%. And people are like, well, if you're not, if you're older and you're not talented and you're not hungry, you just take a little risk. And people ask, why 4%? I'm like, well, five's too much, three's too little. Three, you're going to be bored. Five, you're going to be overstimulated. The people who came up with this, I believe, is Mike Gervais, a
I know I am, yeah.
sports psychologist. Yeah. So anyway, step a little bit out of your comfort zone. This is what Alex Honnold did. He doesn't have a damaged amygdala. The first year in Yosemite, he would step 4% out of his comfort zone day after day after day, put a dot outside that circle until the first year, connect the new dots. This is his new comfort zone. It's bigger. And then the next year in Yosemite, willingness to feel fear, take a risk, step out of the comfort zone, put a dot out there, put a dot out there, connect the dots after year two. This is now his comfort zone. And here's the thing, it's very expensive for the body to manufacture fear, energetically. And so the body doesn't want to have to manufacture fear if it doesn't have to. And if you expand your comfort zone, all of a sudden the body's like, ooh, I don't have to manufacture fear. This is his new Alex in this case, comfort zone. And what I'm saying is that the only way to have less fear is to take risks and expand your comfort zone in that way. And think about that. It's not the way to have less fear is not by blocking it out or going numb or rationalizing it away or replacing it with calm or any of those things. Those are just resistance patterns that people are in. And fear times resistance equals a lot of issues. So willingness to feel fear. And then what do you do with the fear when you're out of your comfort zone? You have intimacy with it. As a perform, so it becomes a performance enhancer. And this is the process by which you expand your comfort zone until 10 years in, Alex Honnold free solos El Capitan, or a few years later climbs that building. So that's the process of expanding your comfort zone. It's by willing to feel fear, intimacy with fear, saying yes to fear, all of those things, none of which is taught, by the way. Resistance is almost unanimously taught, and not every athlete does this. When I interviewed Alex Honnold and Laird Hamilton, they were two of 26 professional danger sports athletes that were at the top of their game that I interviewed for a movie that was made about my life. The movie was called Voices of Fear. And I interviewed these athletes for 2 hours each, and I started with one question, and this is all we talked about. What is your relationship with fear? And of those 26 athletes, only three of them said, oh, I would have to say I have an intimate relationship with fear. And all of these three were in their 40s, had contemplated it quite a bit, and were the best in the world at their sports. One of them was Laird Hamilton. He has an intimate relationship with fear. He is not fearless. And then the other 23 athletes, 20 of them had no idea what their relationship was with fear, including Alex. They just cited cliches like, I don't let it get the better of me, or I let it go. I think positive thoughts. But once I shared this concept of willingness to feel fear, how we're all in love with fear, intimacy with fear, I thought their heads were going to explode. They're like, oh my gosh, that's absolutely what's going on when I'm performing at my best. And then the other three athletes became really upset and angry that I would even suggest that they might have fear. One of them, a woman, was very stoic, very masculine, saying, I have no fears, and it was affecting her personality. And the other two were guys that one of them almost punched me in the face just for even suggesting that he had fear, ripped off his microphone and stormed out of the room. And the other got really red in the face and almost started crying and was really embarrassed and also looked like he was going to punch me in the face. So, what I'm saying in telling you about these 26 athletes is that A, this is not taught. B, this is not common knowledge. And C, most of these athletes have no idea what their relationship is with fear that is happening underneath their conscious mind or their conscious awareness. And then the last thing is that once people start to have an awareness who are at a high level, those three people who, men, they were all men, that said that they had an intimate relationship with fear, they were the best of the best of the best in the world at their respective sports. And so this is what the best of the best are tapping into that most people don't even know that they're even tapping into. And then the second best in the world can often be just in denial of fear or trying to get rid of it or being in their heads all the time so they don't have to feel it. So this is not, common knowledge. This is not being taught. We're just starting to tap into this through me and a few other people, seeing fear as a performance enhancer in this way and how to deal with it. That gives people that upper edge that is becoming more and more necessary, not only in sports if you want to be competitive, but also in the workplace. I'm giving a 90-minute keynote to Microsoft tomorrow to help people get in touch with their fear so that as AI is around, intelligence is being taken care of by AI. And so, what's going to replace it in terms of what's going to make somebody successful in the workforce is also being able to feel emotions as a performance enhancer and a way to tap into intuition, vulnerability, all of that. Empathy, if you can't even feel your own emotions, how can you feel for somebody else? Like everything that we want in all aspects of living comes from a willingness to feel emotions, in particular fear, which is the hardest one.
I think everything that just came out of your mouth for the last 3 minutes is fascinating. And I don't know why somebody would want to punch you in the face based on, because you're not challenging anybody. You're just there to almost like a, you're getting your doctorate. You're extracting information from these people like Laird and Alex who have done amazing things. And just like, you're just asking the question. And I got to tell you that I think I fall in the same category as what Laird was able to articulate about having that intimate relationship, as you mentioned. I just have never thought about that way, right?
Nobody
Because
has. This
nobody
is
has.
so new.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, I don't want to punch you in the face. I'm thanking you, actually. Yeah,
Oh, good.
absolutely opposite, because I've never thought about, it's just like, again, I didn't start off in the NFL. I started off in Little League when I was seven and playing against 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds and making my way up. And I did the same thing in mountaineering, right? Where my comfort level, I became more and more intimate with going through the Kumba ice fall and having big, gigantic ice blocks come down and having avalanches come down on me and having to deal with that and not panic in that moment because my fear would get the best of it. That didn't happen like in one day, in one moment, right? It's happened over the course of time of being more and more and more and more used to. I mean, so much so that I moved to Tucson Valley, Idaho, so I could live in altitude and weather. You're down in Salt Lake City. You probably don't have quite the weather, but you're still a stone's throw away to Park City and Snowbird and Alta and those places where they do have snowstorms, and that's where the ski resorts are. So it's a very fascinating, I think it's totally fascinating what you're coming up with and the way you're looking at it and the way you're articulating how people can move forward. So people not like, by the way, free solo was insane. I loved it. And I knew the outcome and I was still freaked out watching them climb up the side of the rock. And I've done Half Dome several times. And I like that is intense in its own, but El Cap is a whole different level, right? And for him to go up that free solo and no ropes and was really amazing. So switching over to somebody, because I also know people who like in your Microsoft audience, for example, and there's just normal people that are sitting there that are like, well, look, I'm not, surfing a 100-foot wave and I'm not going up the Matterhorn and I'm not climbing El Cap. I have a complete fear of going in a plane, right? Like the turbulence, so much so it's blocking them from actually taking trips. John Madden, the old Raider coach, used to travel around the States in a bus from game to game. He used to do Monday Night Football. And he would travel from stadium to stadium all through the country throughout the season. You could just get in an airplane and go because 1 week would be New York, and the next week would be out in LA, and then back to Philly. And it's just constant, these cross country. So they had this Madden cruiser that they came up with, but because of his fear of flying, right? So I'm asking, like, not in an extreme athlete sense, but just from a normal person that they're letting fear, dictate the way they live their life.
Again, language shift. They're not letting fear. We don't have any control over what fear does.
Yeah.
And that word, like letting it, is suggests that we do. 8.5 billion people on the planet, 8.5 billion unique relationships with fear. Most people have a paradox going on where they say, yes, I want to feel this in some aspects of my life, but in others they don't. And if we have a compromised relationship with fear in any of area of our lives, it goes back to where we started the conversation about insomnia, for example.
Yeah.
If somebody has a compromised relationship with fear in any area of their lives, it's fear is supposed to flow like water through a hose through our bodies and provide for us on point intuitive physical reaction without thought. It never gets into our minds in the form of fight, flee or freeze, and then after the threat is gone, be out of our system in 10 to 90 seconds. And it's the perfect design. But if we kink the hose on that flow of fear, which, by the way, we're taught to do by the anxiety healthcare industry, by experts on fear, psychologists, self-help gurus, doctors, all of that, we stop the flow and then it gets trapped in our bodies and recirculates round and round. And then it causes all sorts of problems in our lives. When I say resistance, fear times resistance equals troubles. Resistance is a catch-all word to describe any number of relationships with fear, including coping mechanisms, rationalizing it away, meditating it away, taking a pill, drinking alcohol, going for a jog, like anything we do to not deal with fear is resistance, going numb. Trying to control it through cognitive behavioral therapy or positivity practices, all these things, to fear, I like to personify fear, not dealing with it through alcohol or drugs, or not dealing with it by going for a run. It's all the same thing, or meditating it away or replacing it with calm. Like, All these things that we're taught to do regarding fear, conquering and overcoming it, is actually the problem. Kink the hose, and all of a sudden that fear will show up in also 8.5 billion different unique problems that people now have. And one of them is a phobia. Like fear will not be denied. It will do anything it can to get our attention if the hose is kinked. It'll show up as an exaggerated version of itself in the form of anxiety, excessive worry, or it'll show up redirected in other ways. If we're really good at, being in denial of fear, well, we have to feel something. So all of a sudden we'll feel incredible anger or jealousy or shame or even sadness, depression. Or it'll hijack our minds and show up in the middle of the night when we're trying to sleep, because it's stuck in our system. It has nowhere else to go. And it'll go into whatever place, if we're living in our heads, if we're dealing with it intellectually, it'll show up in our thoughts. And it'll show up as phobias. And you could maybe get past the phobia of flying, but it's like a whack-a-mole situation. If you're still continuing to be in resistance to fear, it'll then all of a sudden you'll have a phobia of mannequins or peanut butter on the roof of your mouth, or it'll show up in it as insomnia. It'll show up as an anger issue. It's like, it will not be denied. And until and unless we turn towards it and learn how to feel it, emotions want to be felt. They don't want to be understood or thought about or controlled or managed or any of that. Until we learn how to feel them, it will be that whack-a-mole situation, and it'll show up in a variety of ways. And we won't make the association with, oh, it's because I when I gave that speech, I rationalized away the fear. We don't realize that, oh, a month later, that's why I can't sleep. Because that fear is just stuck in our bodies and we never dealt with it.
I bet tomorrow, Microsoft, you will kill it. So good luck to you on that. Of course, you will have no fear, right? Being able
Of course I'm going to have fear.
to
No. If there's
Yeah.
only one thing that is the takeaway, there's no such thing as no fear.
Well, I would
It's
say
an
it this way.
impossible ideal.
But where I guess where I'm going with this is that I've found this conversation super fascinating, especially for the things that I have done over these years. And I think other people that listen to this pod are going to get a lot of value out of this because I've never had this conversation with anybody. And so you've kind of unlocked a whole new way of thinking about this. And so tomorrow, because you're such a great subject matter expert at what you're talking about and the things that are coming out of your mouth, which make a lot of sense. I think a lot of people are going to really relate to you, and you're just feeding them the information to soak up and understand in the way that they can deal with all these things that are coming out there to give them fear, I guess, because of AI and the other things that you were talking about, right? That how they're going to process that. So, where can people find you? I know you have a book out, Art of Fear. I'm sure it's amazing. I'm going to read it. It's going to apply a lot to my life, but tell people where they can find you.
KristenUlmer.com. If you want to figure out what your unique relationship is with fear, go to my website. There's a free fear and anxiety assessment on the homepage. It's 20 really, really interesting questions that get the juices flowing and help you think about what your relationship with fear might be. And then based on the results, you get some really helpful advice on what to do next based on your relationship with fear that's unique to you.
I love that. In the book, you can also buy on your website.
No, on Amazon, just wherever books are
Amazon.
sold.
So I have the same answer as well. You also mentioned a movie. I would love to see that. Is that YouTube or where is that?
You actually can only watch the trailer. The director has not re released it past the world tour. There's a few reasons why, but it's called Voices of Fear. And I think it's on the trailer's on Vimeo, and you can always reach out to me and I can find a way to get you to a chance to see it.
That is awesome. You are a woman of many talents, and congratulations on all your accomplishments, and especially the transition. I call it life after football, but that is that void of what are you going to do now? And it seems like you've really settled into your space, and it's such a cool thing to see. So congratulations on that.
Well, it's interesting with professional athletes, and I see this in you too, where if we don't reinvent ourselves, I've probably 10 different times since my ski career, and you have as well, like, and do other things, like people can get really stuck in the past, and
Yeah.
it's very hard as a world-class athlete to move on
Yeah.
from what would seem like a highlight of your life to now have new highlights, which
Yeah.
clearly we both have done.
It's a great way to live. You know, everything is out there in the future, and forward thinking versus just looking behind on what you accomplished 20 years ago. In my case, like 40 years ago, who cares? So I'm glad that I have been able to, you know, maneuver my way through life and learn new skills and crafts and interests. So I think that's what makes the world go around. And again, I thank you so much for coming on the pod.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. There she is, the one, the only superstar, Kristen. Thank you so much. All right.